now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Morody and Ann Mustu on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston.
It was a mixed day on Wall Street, just like the weather today, a mix. I'm Ann Mustu here in the Bloomberg 106.1 newsroom with my bureau chief and co-host Tom Morony.
Hi, Ann. So today we have a lot to get to as usual, and I want to lay that out for us. Nick Doherty of Mass Challenge is here with what's percolating on the tech scene in Boston. I'll be really eager to hear what he has to say. There's a new round of applicants he has for his program.
Yes.
New startups. This is what Boston is all about. In a tale that I frankly didn't believe, and I know Ann, we found it both hard to believe, a successful CEO in Europe suddenly haunted by allegations made by the Boston FBI 25 years ago.
Yes.
So find out what he did and how his past finally caught up with him.
It's a great story.
It's really, in this, you know, so stay tuned for that. Tomorrow, I have to mention this, one of my favorite segments all summer, I believe. Recreational vehicles. There are people who feel that the sale of RVs is booming and that this could be a new leading indicator for the U.S. economy. So we'll talk about that.
Fascinating point. I'm very curious to hear more.
Yeah, so that's tomorrow. But before we get to all that, I imagine we're going to want to do a little check on the markets, correct?
That's right, Tom. You have the national numbers in front of you?
I do. So the dollar, as you say, rallied. U.S. stocks mixed. Dow Jones up 5.5 points, closing at 21,999. S&P 500 down a point at 2464. NASDAQ down 7 points, ending the day at 6333. I will tell you that gold in the end slumped again, and oil slid for a second day. So that's a quick look at the national scene. What about locally, Ann?
Locally, Tom, the Bloomberg Boston Index down today 0.3% at 128.29. Among some of the winners today on Wall Street, TJX up 0.8%, Teradyne up 0.7%, Tesoro up 0.7%, and Biogen also up 0.7%. Not a big day for winners or losers. On the laggers list, TripAdvisor down 1.9%, Raytheon down 1.2%, Vertex down 1.2%, and Akamai down 1% today.
Those are some of our bigger companies here in the Bay State, though.
That's right. That's right. And in what I think is the most interesting story of the day, Tom, and maybe for commuters listening, we have a new MBTA general manager.
Uh-huh.
Announced today. He is a business executive with experience in corporate turnarounds, but not with public transit. He's a former General Electric executive named the general manager and CEO of the MBTA, Luis Manuel Ramirez. He worked at GE from 2000 to 2012. He finished as president and CEO of GE's Energy Industrial Solutions business. And most recently, he ran his own strategic turnaround consulting firm. He is, of course, succeeding interim MBTA general manager Steve Poftak on September 12th.
Well, you know, there were some people who believe Poftak was headed for that job, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
They went outside the agency. Interesting, they found somebody from GE.
It is interesting. And I wish him luck because that is one tough job.
Oh, yeah.
And also, Teamsters news. Have you been following this story, Tom?
I have been following this story because, of course, it breaks into, I wouldn't call it, it's not reality TV, is it? Or is it Top Chef?
Yeah,
program?
It's considered to be a reality cooking show.
Okay.
As you know, a bunch of Teamsters were accused of attempting to extort jobs from the company filming the show. And I believe it was in Dorchester and Milton. Federal prosecutors say they still believe the four Teamsters who were acquitted today crossed the line and broke the law. Acting U.S. Attorney William Weinreb called their conduct an affront to all of the hardworking and law-abiding members of organized labor. Prosecutors say the men threatened the non-union crew and cast members of Top Chef, and a federal jury found the men not guilty today after 20 hours of deliberations.
Kind of surprising, given the evidence we saw in that trial. For sure, they crossed the line, at least of good manners. Now, apparently, It wasn't found that they had crossed the line according to the law. So, but this is a group that has had some of these same accusations pinned on them in the past.
That's right.
So people around here in Boston understand this is a tough crew, and sometimes allegedly they can get carried away. So
yeah, it's a reputation that matters because they are filming a lot of films here, and as long as that film tax credit exists, right, they'll continue to film them here as long as they think it's a good place
to come.
Well,
the Boston Herald actually did a story a week and a half ago or so. They talked to production companies and others involved in the movie industry, some who said that the reputation of these guys, the toughness, have given them second thoughts about doing business in Massachusetts, which is unfortunate
because it is.
We do try to cultivate that scene.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to take a quick listen to something our president said earlier this afternoon, and it's about Charlottesville. It's about the protests turned violent and lethal there. And let's hear a bit of what he said.
And white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people, but you also had troublemakers.
So that was Trump. This was a press conference for infrastructure.
Yeah.
Of course, the press, you know, starts peppering with questions about Charlottesville. And it's almost as if our president couldn't help himself. He had to jump right into that debate. And as we heard on that sound, saying, well, there was wrong on both sides. It's not what a lot of people wanted to hear. And I'm wondering what his advisors are saying at this point as far as, Mr. President, why did you wade back into this?
Right. His communications team must be working very hard tonight.
But we play that because there is a local angle to this story. The Globe reporting today that there was or is a rally scheduled for Saturday on Boston Common. Three of the headliners, so to speak, told the Globe in a story today, published today, that they would not be participating. This includes Augustus Invictus, an Orlando activist who took part in the Charlottesville rally, said he wasn't coming. There were two others as well. So it's, at this point, Ann Mostu, it's unclear whether they'll have this rally in Boston. The Globe story did say that there was one speaker scheduled, not as well known in these circles as these other three, that said he was still coming. So this remains to be seen whether this will happen. Both the mayor, Mayor Walsh, and the governor, Governor Baker, have spoken out and said, we don't want you here.
That's right. That was a rally or a press conference they had yesterday. So we'll see. Other local news, the Bay State wanting to know whether investors are getting ripped off because their brokers are paid to send orders to U.S. stock exchanges. It's a practice driving much of the trading, the state calling it a $27 trillion market. Here, Secretary of the Commonwealth William Galvin said today he's examining these incentive payments, he's calling them kickbacks, to see if they create conflicts of interest and result in investors' orders not being executed in the best way possible. He sent letters to brokers, including Charles Schwab, Fidelity, and Morgan Stanley. So that's an interesting story.
It's interesting because the ramifications are throughout the industry. If in fact it is found that these are what Galvin says they are, kickbacks, these could have profound implications for anybody who does business in this way. And I will, as a programming note, Secretary Galvin, we have booked him for Bloomberg TV later in the week here on Bloomberg, so please stay tuned for that. Galvin is known for these causes.
Yeah.
He takes a local cause. He saw an op-ed piece where two academics were talking about this, and including David Swenson, who runs the Yale Endowment. And Galvin decided, you know, wait a minute, I'm going to take a look at what's happening in my backyard. He is the top cop for financial regulation in Massachusetts, so he's an important voice in this.
Yeah.
And he decided that there's something he ought to look into. So we'll keep an eye on this. And again, Galvin will be on later this week on Bloomberg Television.
That's right.
Hey, I got a story here about Harvard, and I know you just love Harvard News, don't you, Anne?
All of Bloomberg loves Harvard News. Mike Bloomberg loves Harvard News.
There you go. So Harvard keeps its top spot in the Chinese ranking of best universities. This is called the Academic Ranking of World Universities, compiled by the independent Shanghai Ranking Consultancy. Sounds very official to me.
Yeah.
It's ranked the top 500 institutions each year. Harvard is number one. What's so interesting about this, we've done some work here in the Boston office about just how many children from China, these well-to-do Chinese families, want their children at Harvard. And you see this, you know, when the springtime, when these college tours are just droves of young Asian people over there. And so a very important ranking there. And again, Harvard keeps the top spot. I guess that's not a big surprise.
Not really. Interesting anecdote. Some friends of mine who are raising a child in Cambridge have a landlord who is a 19-year-old student at Harvard. Her parents bought her a house.
Wow.
Yeah, her parents bought her house, and she said, I don't want to live in it. I want to live on campus. And so they rent it out.
Interesting. All right. So that's a quick look at the news, a quick look at the markets, a mixed day on Wall Street. Coming up, we talk to Nick Doherty. He's with Mass Challenge. We'll see what's percolating on the tech scene. And later, a tale you don't want to miss. A CEO in Europe is suddenly haunted by allegations made by the Boston FBI 25 years ago. The lengths they went to get this guy and what they're going to do now. I'm Tom Maroney with Ann Mostu. It's the Bay State Business Hour, 106.1 Boston.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston.
A mixed day for stocks and the dollar on Wall Street. I'm Ann Mostu here in our Bloomberg 106.1 studio with my bureau chief and co-host Tom Maroney.
And more details on what Ann just said. Dow Jones up 5.5 points, closing at 21,999. S&P 500 down a point at 2464. NASDAQ down 7 points, closing the day at 63.33. Gold in the yen slumped again. Oil slid for a second day. And there you have it, Ann Mostu. What about the local scene?
Thanks, Tom. Locally, the Bloomberg Boston Index down 0.3% today at 128.29. I will mention this show is brought to you by Bentley University. At Bentley, you'll benefit from convenient online courses and a flexible GMAT waiver. See how a Bentley MBA can upgrade your pay grade at bentley.edu/upgrade.
All right, joining us now in studio, Nick Doherty. He is the program director for Pulse at Mass Challenge. We all know about Mass Challenge, but Pulse is the digital health division.
That's correct.
How am I doing so far?
You're good.
So
great.
You are opening bids or applications for the 2018 season. You take in these companies with a $5 million or less in revenue and funding, and you accelerate them. You make them stars. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think what's really exciting about the Pulse program that's, I think, different than the Mass Challenge program, which has had amazing success over the years. There's been over 1,200 companies that have gone through Mass Challenge worldwide, not just in Boston, but in Israel, Switzerland, Mexico, London, and just we're also looking to expand in other locations around the world and in the country. And that's an industry agnostic program. So what's unique about Pulse is that this is our first time looking at digital health only and really looking at a specific industry vertical. And so when we look at accelerating our companies, the normal Mass Challenge program will give you incredible mentors, free office space, tons of equity-free cash. So the Boston program gives out $1.5 million and no strings attached cash to the startups that come through that program. So it's really important to us that startups come first and that we help startups win. But with the Pulse program, another unique aspect to it is that we're looking at a little bit later stage companies. So this is not a program for the idea stage. This is a program for companies that have a product that works and that can be deployed. And it's also a program where when you get in, you receive an offer from one of our partner organizations to collaborate. So that's a really unique part of our program is that it's demonstration project driven. And every startup that comes in receives sort of a Shark Tank style offer. It's not necessarily for equity, but it may be for a collaboration.
And Nick, are you focused more on telemedicine or mobile devices? What are you looking for?
So I'd say that we have a pretty diverse perspective on what constitutes digital health. So to us, it's tech-enabled healthcare. So it could be telemedicine, it could be a connected device, it could be a new mobile application, it could be a wellness product that's tech-enabled. So we really, you know, cast a broad net because we're looking to improve the way that we deliver care using technology.
Last week we had a CEO of InCrowd here. Are you familiar with the company?
I'm not.
Yeah, they're in Boston. And what they do is they can survey quickly a group of doctors or nurses so that companies can see the efficacy of pills or their instruments they may be using. And that, I guess that is an example of digital health. I wonder, generally speaking, how does Boston do in this sector? Put aside the program for a moment. Is this the place to be for digital health? And where are your competitors?
So I'd say that we are definitely in the top of that category. I think it's debatable whether or not we're number one yet. It's definitely our goal to be number one.
Who might be number one if you're not?
So I'd say that you look at Boston, Silicon Valley, New York City, San Diego, but there are some other locations around the country that are popping up that are strong in this area, but it's still an area that's up for grabs, which is why Governor Baker, Marty Walsh, the Mass Competitive Partnership came together and said, we want to be number one in the world, which happened in January of 2016 when they launched the Digital Health Initiative here in Massachusetts. Part of that launch was setting aside some funding for the Pulse program to be the innovation hub and startup hub for the initiative.
Again, our guest is Nick Dougherty of Mass Challenge and the Pulse program. Nick, how much redundancy is there in these applications or these business startup ideas, even if they are moving forward with getting going off the ground? And do you give that feedback to applicants that, you know, somebody already has their idea and they're doing it better?
Yeah, so a big part of what we're doing is you have to say who your competitors are in your application, and you have to say how you differentiate from your competitors in the application. That's an important part for us when they're going through their online judging. So we have directors and above that are reviewing these applications. So last year, we had 439 applicants from over 20 countries and over 30 states. So we had a pretty diverse representation of not just ideas, but also sort of the physical landscape and location. And so we definitely push for them to communicate where their differences are, what makes them different, what makes them good. And our judges really help us cut through to find what are the best companies in these categories.
Could you identify, and I call it a race to the moon energy around any particular idea or problem in digital health? Is there one thing that's like everybody's racing to figure out how to do?
Well, I'd say that there's such a diverse set of problems in digital health. It's more like we need to create the infrastructure that supports a tech-enabled healthcare system. So we've recently adopted electronic health records, which essentially serve as the infrastructure that underlies and allows for technology to exist. And so this is an entirely new frontier where people are starting to finally build the applications on top of it. So you can think of the electronic health record like the iPhone and, you know, iOS as a platform and the App Store. We just opened the App Store. Now it's time to build all the apps on top of it. And so that's kind of where we are. It's this sort of arms race to take care of everything else.
Yeah, it's so interesting about digital records. I was talking to a doctor over the weekend who travels abroad to do mission work, and he said the reason he can do so many surgeries so fast is he just doesn't have to deal with medical records.
Yeah,
but you know,
well, they also raise all kinds of privacy issues too, I would imagine.
Ideally, we're just streamlining them, though, right? We're just getting them.
And I'd say that's a big area of focus. So you asked about an area of focus. Cybersecurity is definitely a huge one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, two of the governor's initiatives are around cybersecurity and around digital health. And that's not by coincidence. That's something where you really can't have strong digital health without incredible cybersecurity.
So, Nick Dougherty, thank you so much for dropping by. It's Pulse at Mass Challenge. How can people find ways to apply for this new season? At your website, I imagine.
Yeah, so if you go to masschallenge.org/apply, you can apply for the program. And if you get in, you get a partner. It's an amazing program.
Coming up, new life for the alkaline battery on a large scale. I'm Tom Moroney with Ann Mastu. This is Bloomberg.
From the Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington, I'm Adrienne Mitchell with headlines. President Trump has equated the actions of white supremacists and neo-Nazis with those whom he called the alt-left. Trump originally said Saturday that many sides bore blame for the violence. At a news conference this afternoon, he repeated that theme, saying there is blame on both sides for the disturbances. South Korea's president says any decision to go to war with North Korea should be made by his country and not by anyone else, and he vows to prevent war at any cost. President Moon's speech in sharp contrast with President Trump's fire and and fury rhetoric. After three CEOs stepped down from the president's manufacturing council, Newell Brands CEO Michael Polk says he will stay in the group to maintain a voice in the conversations. Global News, 24 hours a day, powered by more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. I'm Adrian Mitchell. Now let's get a check on the markets and the latest business headlines.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston.
Rallies and falls, a mixed day on Wall Street.
By the numbers, Dow Jones up 5.5 points, closing at 21,999. S&P 500 down a point at 2464. The NASDAQ down 7 points, ending the day at 6333. Ann Mostu.
Well, Tom, the Bloomberg Boston Index today was down 0.3% at 128.29. Among the winners today, TJX, Teradyne, Tesoro, Biogen, and on the laggers list, TripAdvisor, Raytheon, Vertex, and Akamai. Joining us now is Brian Eckhouse of Bloomberg News, and Brian's going to talk to us about the future of batteries, starting with a Woburn-based company, Ionic Materials. Welcome, Brian.
Hey, Ann.
Talk to us a little bit about what's news in the world of Ionic and batteries.
So Ionic's trying to find a way to bring in what they say is both safer and cheaper batteries than what's pretty common out there. The common battery is lithium ion. These can be found in your phone. They can be found in other sort of sorts. But with some of the with some cell phones having problems on airplanes, and the fact that lithium ion can be expensive despite a very strong decline in price over the last few years, some people think that you can possibly find a way to compete with it. And Ionic's one of those companies trying to compete.
All right. So, Brian, Ionic came up with this alkaline battery, solid state, as you describe it, that really performs better than the lithium ion. Would anybody be saying at this point, if this all works out well, this is the end of lithium ion?
I think it's premature. They themselves would say that, you know, like they've got technology that could be much cheaper, much safer. It seems, in their point of view, the way to go. But it's not been commercialized yet. You need factories to go and build it. You know, they're looking to license out the technologies, people that, you know, on their own can manufacture it and build it. So it's still like it's an idea. It seems promising, but it's still years away from being something that's realistic.
And to be clear, we're talking about really large batteries. And tell us about what Ionic is thinking about doing or powering with these batteries.
The batteries can actually be very, very small. Part of the brilliance or the appeal of batteries, whether it's lithium ion or it's the solid-state alkaline, is that they're scalable. So you can put, like, dozens or hundreds in one spot. So it creates, like, one large battery in effect, but actually a series of many small batteries. And in terms of use, I mean, consumer electronics, automotive, and the power grid.
Yeah, Brian Eckhouse is our guest. He's a Bloomberg News reporter. We're talking about this new battery, this new solid-state alkaline battery that has real potential for really thrashing the lithium ion battery. Brian, talk about, you said the grid. Do you have any details on how these new batteries would be used in the grid?
Very often utilities and the grids themselves try to find ways to mitigate periods where like there's a strong surge of power or there is a deficiency of power. And often they turn on some power plants that only are needed at like peak times of the day. And they're very expensive to run, they run natural gas, and they're difficult to permit, particularly in New England, where there isn't that much space to go and put new power plants. The appeal of batteries are you can go put them in various spots in cities around the grid to go and fill in those gaps. They can be small, they can be very big. That's true for lithium ion, that's true for alkaline. And we're seeing more and more utilities and grid operators put these all around. It's more common in Southwest and California. We're seeing it a little bit in Illinois, a bit in New York and New Jersey, but it's coming to the whole country.
And in your story, Brian, you quote Bill Joy of Silicon Valley and Sun Microsystems saying that what people didn't really realize is that alkaline batteries could be made rechargeable. Do you see a future with this?
If it is commercialized and if it is indeed rechargeable, it would have tremendous appeal. lithium ion is viewed as a way to go and make wind and solar more real. The problem with wind and solar is that they're intermittent. You can't get wind around the clock. You don't get sun at night. So these are power sources that can't compete directly with natural gas if they don't have something to complement them. If you're using more, if you're using batteries, you can use batteries alongside a solar farm at night, so you suddenly have around-the-clock power, which right now solar lacks. So if you suddenly have a battery that is cheaper to build and safer than lithium ion, it's that much more, it has that much more of an appeal. But the problem is that lithium ion has got a huge head start. Bloomberg Energy Finance, BNEF, found that there was a decline in the cost of lithium ion battery packs of almost 3/4 in the last 6 years. That's a very strong decline, and it gives lithium ion a huge, you know, leg up over any other competitor.
Yeah. So, Brian, why is the price falling that much? Do we have any idea?
It's simply use. A few years ago, people didn't think that batteries were here. People didn't think the batteries were on the verge, but they are. And we're seeing more and more utilities, you know, look to use them, to apply them. In many ways, it sort of mirrors what we saw with solar 7-8 years ago, where solar made a lot of sense. It's renewable. Even places like Massachusetts, where it can be cloudy half the year, there's a great potential to go and have, you know, power from the sun. It's potentially cheaper. It's very expensive. And we saw the cost curve fall for solar significantly. And now people in the power world, the electrical world, say, wait a minute, we saw it with solar. Mm-hmm. It can happen with batteries, too.
Doesn't the price, the falling price of lithium ion, make it more attractive than the alkaline?
Right now it does. Right now. Because it's here. They can use it right now. It's applicable, and it's coming down in price. Alkaline at this point still remains theoretical to most power companies and utilities.
Brian Eckhouse is with Bloomberg News. Brian, thank you for your time.
Thanks, guys.
And let's take a look at the numbers here in Boston again today. The Bloomberg Boston Index was down today 0.3%. Not a great day for Boston businesses on Wall Street, closing at 128.29. And on the leaders list, TJX, Teradyne, Tesoro, and Biogen. And on the laggers list, TripAdvisor, Raytheon, Vertex, and Akamai.
All right, a week from tomorrow. We kick off a regular feature here we call the C-Suite. It's conversations with Boston's chief executives. And I know you, Ann, and I are really looking forward to this. So I was saying to you earlier today, if anybody has an idea in our audience for a CEO we ought to interview, send us a note at baystatebiz@bloomberg.net. Now, coming up, a story you don't want to miss, a successful CEO in Europe suddenly haunted by allegations made by the Boston FBI 25 years ago. They went to some lengths to catch this guy in the act, and then he disappeared. I'm Tom Maroney with Ann Mastu. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mastu on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston.
Rallies and falls, a mixed day on Wall Street.
By the numbers, Dow Jones up 5.5 points, closing at 21,999. S&P 500 down a point, closing at 2,464. And Ann Mastu, NASDAQ is down 7 points, ending the day at 63.33. Gold in the end slipped again. Oil slid for a second day. And what about the local scene?
A tepid day, Tom, for Boston businesses on Wall Street. The Bloomberg Boston Index tracking the area's biggest businesses down 0.3% at 128.29. So joining us now, we have Kit Shalell, who is a London-based Bloomberg reporter with a great story, a great narrative out right now about a man, a 56-year-old Israeli man named Uzi Katz. He spells his name two different ways. He was identified as a fugitive in a 25-year-old Boston fraud case. He moved to Europe to become a tech CEO and then back again. Kit, tell us the story.
So Uzi Katz, until last week, was best known as being the chief executive officer of a European tech company called Telit, which has some big customers, including Tesla and Cisco and AT&T. And then there was a report in an Italian newspaper claiming that Uzi Katz was, in fact, a wanted fugitive and had been arrested in Boston many years ago, or police had attempted to arrest him, and he'd fled the country. The initial media reports were not definitive about whether it was the same person. The company promised to investigate and hired a law firm. And then on Monday, Tellett announced that he would be standing down. And our story was an attempt to sort of to find out whether it actually it was the same guy, and if so, how he went from a Boston-based fugitive to the head of a large European tech company.
So, Kit, this is really the story of a double life, as it were. Tell us what he was all about in Boston here.
Well, there's lots we don't know about this period of his life. It was a long time ago, and the documentation is a little bit incomplete. We do know that he and his wife were suspected of running a land flip scheme. And this was basically buying and selling properties and getting loans from lenders at inflated rates. So you'd get a loan for a property that was far higher than the actual real value of the property. And prosecutors allege that they basically made fraudulent applications for those loans. And we aren't talking huge sums of money. It was sort of $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 that they were looking to gain, allegedly. The FBI began an investigation and put Uzi Katz's wife, Ruth, under investigation and covertly recorded her at a meeting talking about one of these land deals.
Tell us a little bit about that. That's kind of interesting. The FBI went to some length, some effort to record this meeting. Can you talk about that?
So the FBI contacted a Boston attorney who was due to speak to Ruth Katz about one of these deals, and he consented to a video camera being placed in the meeting room. The FBI also apparently sent an agent to, disguised as a paralegal at this guy's law firm to monitor what was going on. And it appears that some of the evidence against the couple came from this meeting.
It's just incredible to me that Uzi Katz, and I should make it clear to listeners, this is a story about a man, a 56-year-old man, who spelled his name in two different ways. Uzi, O-O-Z-I, or U-Z-I, and then Katz spelled with a K, A-T-Z, or Katz like the animal. So it's just, it's incredible to me that he would try to become a fugitive internationally using the name that's really the same.
It's a homonym, as they said exactly. In English class, right, Kit?
It's a very strange situation. It doesn't appear that he actually tried very hard to disguise his identity. I mean, listen, if you were a fugitive and you wanted to start a new life in another country, you would change your name to something more different than Uzi Katz. So I don't think that's what he was attempting to do. There's also the situation of he visited the state several times after leaving as a fugitive. He even came back to Boston at one point for a conference, it looks like. And he listed on that application, visa application form, the alternative spelling of his name, which was UZI, which is the name in the criminal indictment. So it doesn't appear like he was trying to hide this, and it's not clear what he was thinking or you know why he didn't make more effort to disguise the fact that he was once wanted by the FBI.
So when he left Boston, this is when he embarked on this second life. Talk a little bit more about that. Give us some details of what he did once he went over to Europe.
So again, we're sort of patching together incomplete information, but what we do know is that he's an Israeli national. At some point, he went back to Israel. And there he started a vehicle service company called Auto Depot Limited. And that was apparently quite successful, and he ran that for a few years. At some point, he got involved in technology companies, and he seems to have had a relationship with a venture capital investment firm called Polar Investments. And it looks like it was through Polar that he became a shareholder in and chief executive of this Italian company that was trading under the name Tellett.
So, you know, does law enforcement allege that was any wrongdoing in that part of his life, or does that seem to be a fairly clean slate?
It's not clear. There's certainly by the U.S. authorities, there's no allegation against him from his time in Israel or in Europe. Yes, it doesn't appear that that's the case. And it appears that he was a successful CEO of Telit. You know, it was a company that wasn't doing great things when he took over in around 2000. And it grew very quickly afterwards. You know, whatever he was doing there, he was doing something right. He changed the company's profile. He positioned it as a supplier in the Internet of Things, which is, you know, became a hot area. And the company did really well under his leadership.
So what do you think is next for him? Obviously, he's in a lot of trouble. I mean, he's been on a fugitive for 25 years from this Boston fraud case. So what's the next step for him?
Well, it definitely seems like his career at Telit is over. The board expressed outrage that he hadn't disclosed to them these criminal charges in the U.S. So it doesn't. I don't think he's going to be rejoining Telit as an executive anytime soon. In terms of the status of the U.S. investigation, it was such a long time ago. We called prosecutors and attorneys to try and get a sense of the status of the probe, and there was no clear answer coming back beyond that, you know, that the warrants had never been dropped and were technically still active. It doesn't seem like there's an active investigation in Boston against him. But I wonder now, in the light of all the publicity that's surrounded this case, whether prosecutors in the U.S. might be keen to talk to him again.
Yeah, that's true. Our guess is Kit Shalell. He's a Bloomberg News reporter based in London. He's actually at the courthouse today as we speak to him. I'm fascinated by this idea that there was an article in this Italian newspaper on August 8th. This really started everything. Do you know anything more about that, Kit? How was that a tip? Did somebody see him in Italy? Do you know how that happened?
We don't know how that happened. Logically, it must have been a tip. 25-year-old documents from the U.S. don't suddenly appear in European newspapers unless someone has provided them. So someone tipped them off. Several publications in Europe have also picked up the story as well. An interesting fact is that Mr. Katz himself bought a significant chunk of stock in the company on August the 8th. On the day of publication of this story. It's not clear why he did that. So there's lots of things going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. One of the things we do know is happening is that short sellers have targeted this stock and have done for several months. And there's a hedge fund, a London-based hedge fund in particular, that has a very large short position against the company and stands to benefit from any fall in its share price.
Great story. And Ann Mostow, I'll just tell you that it's not reminiscent of Whitey Bulger, but there are some parallels here.
Yeah, there sure are.
I mean, he was Whitey Bulger, I'm not sure you know who that is, Kit Shalell, but he was a fugitive here, a bad guy here in Boston. He was gone for 25 years as well. They did finally catch up to him. So we will, here on this end, check with the FBI to see what's happening. We thank you for your story.
Thanks a lot. Great to talk to you guys.
Again, that was Bloomberg News reporter Kit Shalell speaking to us characteristically from the basement of a courthouse in London.
Where else would he be in a story like that? A great story, and he's a good storyteller, too.
He really is.
I was, you know, I said to him, as you just heard, about the Whitey Bulger similarities there. I mean, it's just, but the other thing is, as I think about this, you know, there's this activity around the stock now. And he bought some stock on August 8th, the day he was revealed to the world in this Italian newspaper. There's a lot of unanswered questions here.
Right.
That's just unreal.
And we asked Kit after the end of the interview was off the, you know, when we had stopped rolling, where this man had lived, where Uzi Katz had lived. He lived on Comm Ave in Boston.
Pretty good address. All right. We will certainly see if the FBI in Boston has anything to say about this. Coming up tomorrow, don't want to miss this one. The sale of RVs is booming. We asked the question of an RV expert, could this be the making of a new leading indicator on the U.S. economy? In a week from tomorrow, we kick off our regular feature here, the C-Suite Conversations with Boston's top executive.
It's going to be great.
All right. I'm Tom Maroney with Ann Mostow. It's the Bay State Business Hour. 1061 Boston.